Okay, we're here with Jason Horsley at Pyjama Surf's office. You like had a little bit of a struggle to talk to a lot of people, but you did this thing of talking to people just through spontaneity, you know, just without planning, trying. Well, at least what you said. You said that you didn't plan anything.
I mean, it's
trying to.
It's all relative. Flow. It's all relative, right? Yeah. So I didn't have a script. I didn't know it worked out, but I did have some idea. The difficulty, one thing that has helped me to see is that our sense of self comes from the other. So we define ourselves by how the other sees us or how we imagine the other sees us. And that's always changing, so we're different, you know, according to whoever we're with. So then to do like public performance, public speaking, and then like a workshop, that means that my sense of myself is mutating and transforming and rearranging very rapidly. So it's very destabilizing.
So you try that this influence of the other people, other thoughts, everything, that it does not affect you? You try to like block it, or how do you go about that? Just to try to be yourself?
I don't try to block it. That doesn't work. It's like okay, it's a bit of a cliche, but listening to the inner voice, right? Just like the more people are looking at you, or the more stimuli there are, and when someone's looking at you, that's a big stimuli, right? You feel the attention. That's like noise. It's not bad per se, but it's just a lot of information's coming in. It's hard to pass it out. It's impossible, right, to pass it out. So in terms of what I'm talking about now, it's noise to signal ratio. Like the signal is the inner voice. So of course, if you're alone in a cave for weeks or months or years on end, it's pretty easy to tune in and stay tuned into that inner voice.
And in Mexico City, with all these voices going on, like these telepathic fields, just
even just being in the city, I noticed was really disruptive for me. Like, I mean, it was particularly, I landed and I got picked up at the airport by somebody, you know, who had ideas about me, and then I got taken to the Hilton and put up at this very fancy hotel. So it was exaggerated, that experience. But yeah, I felt as soon as I landed or as soon as I arrived at the hotel, I was aware that my inner my experience of my inner self was accelerated, everything was speeded up, and I noticed in my actions, like I was doing all this stuff, and I wanted to Twitter and tweet, and I wanted to film, and I was already in this very accelerated way of being.
And Jason, speaking about like excessive data, we live in an age of too much information, no? Suddenly we can access like a huge amount of information that we couldn't even imagine, I don't know, 20 or 30 years ago. And maybe this phenomenon goes with a search for answers, no? Also, we see lots of information accessible now, but that information not necessarily equals the answers we need in order to mm-hmm. just to be happy or to live in a peaceful way.
No, I was talking to David about this yesterday, that there's living information and then there's dead information. And living information is the only kind that can really nurture and support you in a deep sense. Like, dead information is fine if you're just trying to do something practical, so you need to change a tie, maybe read a manual, because that's dead information. It's not a living transmission, but it works, you can change the tie. But if you're talking about actually living in the sense of an embodied life, that information has to come through the body, it has to come internally. So
it's like information that can be like a lot, living information can be similar to spirit.
The transmission is what David Sharner calls it. I don't use that word actually because I don't want to brand it. Plus, it's not my brand; it's his brand. So, but I try not to call it anything. I just try to call it life. But then of course life means
everything. But it could be more or less like the difference between information and knowledge, no? So you could have
not law even, no, because I would say the same about knowledge, you know, living knowledge, dead knowledge, you know, books, traditions, systems, that's dead knowledge, dead information. I see information, but knowledge is synonymous, but I could say the difference between knowledge and knowing, because knowing is something that's happening in the present.
But what makes information alive? That you imbue sort of a spirit or sort of an energy to that information? What's the difference, no, between information that is alive and information that's dead?
The living information is actually arising in this moment. It's coming. It's coming through from the deepest part within the infinite space within, which is to say that it's coming from somewhere beyond the physical realm.
Okay, so the body can be used sort of as a vehicle to the transcendent, something that it's outside, like the matrix. The body can be used to channel that
interface. Or what?
I wouldn't say that it can be used, because then like what's using it? But the body itself is tapped into the life force, and the life force is like a carrier signal for the spirit, or the transmission, or that living knowledge, whatever you want
experience
to call it. Well, experience is what we have perceptually, like the body then perceives, and that's experience. But that source code, or whatever you want to call it, it's even beyond experience, because experience is already, that's something that's stamped in time in some way. So, but the living, that living light is timeless, it's eternal.
Which was when you said before that our only context is eternity. You said that in the bonus thing.
So that's the thing, like if you put, and that was part of what I was trying to get to, is that if you put things in the context of eternity, what happens? Like, people think of eternity as a really long period of time, but it's not, right? It's infinite time, right? Infinity isn't a really big space.
Yeah.
Because that's, you can conceive and encapsulate with the mind, no matter how big it is. The thing with infinity is that, you know, the largest number you can imagine is no closer to infinity than the number one. You haven't got any closer to eternity, no matter how long you exist. So it's not, it's a timeless state. And if there's no time, then there's no sequence. So
like the relationship of eternity with time would be like that eternity is projected into time, like this matrix. Or it's something like completely independent from, or I don't know.
And that's like, well, that's a big question. Yeah. I think time is a mental construct.
And yeah. Jason, lots of people think that in the present, there's it's happening like this sort of conscious revolution. You know, like. A collective feeling of needing to return to the source and maybe some mystic roots, or I don't know. But on the other hand, we have like this, lots of stress, of anxiety, of panic attacks. Mm-hmm. Also, I mean, like in 50 or 100 years from now, we could be seen, or we could pass to history as probably a generation that started to awake after a long numbness or something like that. But we could also pass like the panic attack generation or something like that.
Heavy trauma.
What do you think is the key to having one destiny or the other? You know what I mean? Like some kind of advice or how do you perceive the current age?
Well, I'm not sure how you're going to be able to put this into words, but if the story of the ego ends, it's not like you keep the story and say, this is what I did, and this is my story, and isn't it great, it ended with me being enlightened. When the story of the ego ends, there was no journey. There was no getting from unenlightenment to enlightenment. There was just the waking up from a dream. So history is a collective dream in that sense. So then it doesn't really matter. I mean, it doesn't even mean anything, like when we wake up. Because when we do wake up, it's going to be the same outcome.
It's all time.
It's all just dissolved into eternity. So your question only makes sense from the context of the nightmare of history when we're in it. But you're talking about the possibility of ending the nightmare, and with that possibility,
but
cancels out the question of
but it's
how.
It's, but you say like that. So this cannot be ended collectively. It's like an individual thing to awaken.
I think it's not ended collectively through a catastrophe, through mass death. That's why I'm no longer focusing on the big picture, because to me the most optimistic outcome for our species at this point is collective catastrophe, in which most of the species is destroyed. That's the most optimistic.
But that to trigger something, or
a present situation. Who wants to hear that? You know, I just sound like a.
But what, you say that to because that would trigger, like this crisis would trigger some awakening, or less people could have another relationship with the planet, or
yeah.
Or you say because we should die because it's just a fucked up.
Well, we are going to die anyway, of course. All of us as individuals. So the idea of us dying collectively, that sort of changes the game. Now, I mean, I could go into theories about why that might allow a shift for the whole planet. I'm not sure I should, though, because we could always cut it out, I suppose. But I mean, it's just a concept, and I don't know if I believe it anymore. But the concept I had is that human consciousness is finite. My consciousness is infinite. But humanity is finite. So you talk about human consciousness, it's a finite thing. And so it doesn't matter how many people are on the planet, the same package of consciousness is getting portioned out to those individuals. So then it's getting diluted.
So you think
so it's harder and harder to organize and to have harmony the more packages there are of that consciousness. If there's only two people like Adam and Eve, they'd be fine. You know, the Godhead would exist in a very clear polarity. But when you've got 7 billion, it's just so much fragmentation.
Yeah, it's
that is chaos.
Yeah, it's a strong thing to say, but perhaps.
It is. So I wouldn't want to apply that to social, much less political things, because then you've got
Hitler
and
yeah,
the generals.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
In terms of the individual and the psyche, like the more fragmented we are, the more different drives we have, the more personalities we sustain with our beliefs, the harder it is just to be focused on that silent inner momentum, which is moving us always forward.
So do you think consciousness is finite? It's not an infinite.
Human consciousness.
And but if someone like grows on consciousness, I'm taking from somewhere else. I'm not just like creating consciousness.
What?
If I, for example, grow more consciousness,
like a plant.
Well, I don't know, like get more consciousness, whatever. No, because
for
there is a. You're saying that there is a possibility of like, I don't know, if Adam and Eve had so much consciousness, they're more consciousness than I, no, or more consciousness than more people have. So there is a possibility to have like a transfer of consciousness or get consciousness. No,
I don't see it that way. I mean, I see what you're talking about. Expanding consciousness has to do with Daniel Pinchwick would say that, and others as well, that it's not to do with sort of tuning into the universe and downloading consciousness from the cosmic Akashic records. It has to do with making the contents of the unconscious conscious. So we're already this package of consciousness, which is the soul. But to actually experience it means allowing it to come, the unconscious to come into consciousness and integrating it. And that is what nobody wants to do. That's got nothing to do with, like, it can happen through ayahuasca and stuff, but it's certainly got nothing to do with these great visions of how we're cosmic beings. It has to do with reliving and integrating past trauma and seeing the shadow aspects of our psyche. So yeah, that does correspond with the shamanic journey. I'm not saying they're completely separate, but it's just a lot more mundane and ordinary and everyday process than most, you know, mystical seekers and New Age optimists really allow for, I think.
Moving away from like from the big picture of human species as a whole or that stuff, and going back like to the micro point of view, what do you think it's the best way like to move towards these answers or maybe like this peaceful state? I mean, some call it happiness or I don't know, or enlightenment, or but you know,
I don't think they're the same thing.
No, but that's not. So that's not the point. So you like Jason from a micro perspective. What do you think that are your main tools in order to gain a peaceful state of mind or to grow your consciousness or accelerate your evolution?
Honesty. I don't think there's any other tools that compare. Like there might be a few extra things, but there's nothing really that is on the same level as simply being honest. Like I think that you know, if you have that, then, but if you don't have that, it doesn't matter how many tools you have.
And in a second level, also, if you're able to work your honesty, what would be the next layer of tools or resources in order to keep going?
I'm more inclined to talk about like the results of honesty, because I don't think you need more tools than honesty. I mean, I understand your question, but let's say one of the results of honesty is disillusionment. Because you see yourself more and more in the naked light of truth, and you've got to let go of these illusions. So then, yeah, you would need some extra tools like acceptance, like patience,
humbleness,
humility. So yeah, but they would just naturally develop from that process of honest examination leading to disillusionment, and being honest about the ways in which we try and prevent that disillusionment from happening. Like I've been feeling quite angry today over nothing, and I'm aware that it doesn't have to, I could put it on surface things, which I won't even mention because they are surface that are a bit irritating, but I'm more inclined to say, well, there's going to be a deeper reason for this, and that I've been going through a lot of changes in the last 3 days, and my ego is really threatened by that, and one of the ways that the ego will prevent honesty from undoing it is by getting angry and becoming defensive and saying, what about me?
And we were talking yesterday about the body, no? And we were talking about psychedelics and stuff like that, and I think it's related to honesty, no? Being attuned to your body and taking care of your body as a way, almost perhaps, well, his question, no? Javier's question, might also be that kind of tool, no? Like really taking
sobriety, yeah. I would say, is a very important tool. And sobriety is what it says, being sober. It doesn't just mean being sober-headed, it means being physically sober. But, you know, nobody really wants to hear that, and I certainly don't want to be the one saying, stay away from drugs, kids. But I think that is a very fundamental tool, is that keeping the body as free from toxins as possible. External toxins clears the space for the internal toxins to come up and out.
Yeah, and perhaps like cleansing can also mean a more clear perception, no? As we talked that some, I mean, you see some food and you say, well, should I take this food or not, no? But your body might know if that food is good for you, no? In a way that's instinctive, no? But we perhaps don't have that. Or if I'm thinking of going outside, I'm saying, well, no, I wouldn't go outside because I would get sick, no? I don't know that, but perhaps my body does know, no? So developing that sort of knowledge of the body or perception through the body, you know, and not the mind so much.
Mm-hmm. And Jason, how do you work honesty? I mean, what does it have to do with intuition?
Intuition, I think, to develop intuition does depend on honesty, because intuition is a very subtle signal. So our tendency is always to believe what we want to believe, or what's going to actually support our stories about ourselves, our ideas about ourselves. So, like, discernment, I feel a bit discombobulated because Alejandro left now, I've just got to recalibrate. Discernment is a form of honesty, or is an aspect of honesty. Like, you can't discern. You can only discern to the extent that you can be honest.
Shall we come closer?
Okay. Maybe switch to this chair so it looks more comfortable. It's probably good to think of specifics, like with these sorts, with any kind of conversations. I think it's good to.
But if
be practical.
Exactly. I'm trying to get like a practical output, or at least as practical as we can handle it. But so what would be like the stages or the in order to regain our honesty as individuals? So have you, in your personal process, have you detected like some key moments or key actions or practices that have allowed you to regain this honesty?
Is it regained, or is it gained for the first time?
I don't know. That's another discussion.
Yeah, but, thinking out loud.
Gain or regain? Sorry, to gain for the first time, honesty. I mean, intuition.
I think you have to. I mean, like yesterday, this is as an example. Like, I had a choice, really, and to me, it didn't feel like a choice. But let's just say I had a choice. When I was talking at the beginning of the workshop, and I just wasn't feeling it. It wasn't so much that I didn't know what to say, it was that I couldn't find the place in me from which to say it. So then you could say I had a choice, either just brave it, you know, just push on through that and hope to somehow get to place where I could speak, or to just stop and be honest and say, I don't know what I'm saying and I'm lost now. And the only way to find out if it's possible to be honest in that way or in any capacity is actually just to do it.
But to do what?
To actually let show the thing that you're afraid is going to be seen. So, like, so much of our behavior goes into covering up and concealing.
So dishonesty could be defined as a fear of being yourself, or of discovering who you really are.
Well, maybe at a deep level, maybe there's something to that, but of actually seeing yourself. But in a sort of practically everyday level, dishonesty has to do with trying to maintain an appearance that you want others to see you as. whatever it is, I mean, we have a persona, an identity, and a way of being in the world that we've decided is the right one for us. So whether it's handsome, or witty, or clever, or charming, or seductive, or intuitive, or sensitive, or loving, or kind, or mean, or angry, or aggressive, or tough, or cool. Cool is the one that pretty much everyone, or certainly guys, it's part of their, you know, the necessary qualities to maintain. So, but where does that come from? Like, these are shields. They're masks, the things that we erect to deflect attention, to hide behind.
Yeah, I've seen that when you travel along, when you travel alone, and you're suddenly with a new group of people you just met, and you're, I don't know, in any context, and then you start, I don't know if this has happened to you, then you start like having like strange conducts, or maybe like reactions you don't recognize on you. But then if you think a bit on that, on those reactions, you get to see that they're probably more natural or more you than the usual reactions you could have inside like a familiar context, no? Because in this familiar scenario, you're always like trying to fit in this identity you have projected before, and when you're like in a new context, it's just like, you even surprise yourself about some reactions or some conducts, but they feel like even more organic than your traditional pattern of reactions. No? Have you seen this?
Yeah, and it reminds me of something that Indian Duo, the goal perspective that I know, said about when people spend a long time in the wilderness, they get a certain look to them, which you can almost say it's kind of like an autistic look, but they look almost like they're in a trance or something. Because if you take a person out of a social context and put them in a non-social context, such as nature, because this could happen in solitary confinement, people who get, you know, put in prisons, and people who go off into caves and whatnot, but I think probably the most powerful example would be in nature, because you're still surrounded by living things, but it's not a social context. The self that is a social construct begins to transform and even dissolve, because you don't have these external elements reinforcing it. Like, the world is our mirror. And what do we use a mirror for? We to check our hair, to check how we look. So we're constantly using society and the society of others, the company of others, as mirrors to check. How are we doing? How do we look? Am I still in character? And because we're all doing it to each other, we're all using each other that way, but not consciously. If it was consciously, it would be a completely different thing. I'm not sure if I can finish that sentence, but it becomes... it's like the opposite of a dance. I guess it's something like being in the army. It's regimented.
Like hyper squared, no, or non flexible.
Yes, and I mean, nobody really is enjoying it. It's like we're all agreeing to maintain, support, and continue these social ways of being that none of us actually agreed to, and none of us really understand, or maybe even like that much. But for somebody just to say, hey, we don't have to do that, like to do something completely unexpected, whatever it is. You know, crazy people do that. You get people on the streets, the drunks, crazy people, get clowns, you get the shaman trickster figure, you get the psychopath, you get autists, and so-called, you know, learning disability people who just behave in a way that makes everyone else uncomfortable. I think that that's what happens when you have a really regimented way of being. And it, yes, it squelches any possibility of an honest expression.
And Jason, are there any like dangers in this process of regaining honesty or of getting to be honest for the first time? Are there any like particular dangers that one must confront?
There's the danger of losing face. Like that's the thing that we're almost afraid of. And that.
But that's part of the mission, no? Like to lose your face. But I mean dangers like in a not evolutionary way, or so that you can get like a bit confused on the middle of the road and then end up like fucked up mentally, or I don't know, or maybe like going deeper into your confusion because in a key moment you don't apply correctly your discernment and start following an even more complex or sophisticated illusion than the one you're following currently. So,
well, I think you're turning it into something quite elaborate, is what it sounds like some sort of shamanic practice. Or, the practice of being honest is only dangerous to the ego. It's not like you're tightwalking over an abyss or something. If you're talking about, or if you're thinking about like intense psychological exploration, I think there are risks there, but I think the kind of, that doesn't really happen alone, unless you're going to adopt psychedelics and that kind of thing, which is absolutely the opposite of what I'm talking about. Honestly, it's just observing what's going on naturally without actually trying to force anything to happen. But if you're in a relationship, or if you're in psychotherapy, or with a spiritual teacher, that will accelerate that. And then there's a danger, yes, of getting triggered so severely that you will act irrationally and self-destructively. There's a danger of bringing unconscious matter into consciousness so rapidly that you are overwhelmed and you experience existential anxiety that's so powerful that you can, you know, self-destruct or become destructive. So that's, but that's, I mean, that is just one of the life dangers if you enter into a relationship. Any sort of real psychological intimacy is dangerous in that sense, but so the discernment is very necessary in terms of if you have a spiritual teacher, if you're going to go into psychotherapy, or if you're going to enter into a relationship. And I would put those three together as equally critical, or as an equal degree of commitment and therefore discernment, as far as whether you, this is the right time and the right person to enter into that relationship with.
That's like rising kundalini, no? If you go too fast and you get your kundalini to really come up, and if you're not prepared for that, you can go like bake yourself, no? Like bake your mind.
So I've heard, and I guess I've had my experience, but again, that was from psychedelics. I'm not sure. I suppose there are spontaneous kundalini awakenings. But that's, yeah, I mean, the Kundalini at this point for me is a bit, is just an unknown, really. I think I would see it now more in terms of maybe the same thing, but that there is the unconscious. When we talk about the unconscious, we talk about stuff that has been pushed down into the unconscious, we're talking about what's gone into the body. So the unconscious is the body, in a sense. It's not somewhere out there. It's right here now. You know, like our total being, our total self is the body psyche system. So the more that we clear space in the body for the psyche to inhabit the body and dwell within the body, the more that stirs up, releases the suppressed unconscious content that's been trapped in the body, and vice versa. The more we can bring the unconscious matter into consciousness, the more the psyche is able to come into consciousness, to enter into the body. So then that is a process similar to the Kundalini rising, like the soul dwelling within the body. I would say the Kundalini rising is got it backwards, because the soul is coming down into the body, it's not coming up. I think it's a downward thing. But then the effects of that could be similar to what you might have read about Kundalini rising, is that this energy is being released in the body and it's causing a lot of mental confusion and physical symptoms.
And just a couple more of questions, Jason. I don't know, since 60s or something like that, there's been like a massive movement towards like awakening the ethereal or mystic or spiritual side of humanity, and I feel that always aims like to, you know, up as the like astrology or stuff like that, all the, like to open and even the metaphor of rising the Kundalini, you know, it's always up. Mm-hmm. But then if you observe a bit the context of nowadays, you might get the feeling that actually the new direction that towards we should aim, it's not going up but going down, no? So like really focusing on recovering or going into the root, into the ground, into the, you know, like settle. So we don't longer need like this openness, mind openness towards like the infinite, going up, and you know, the cosmos and the spirit and the, but going like more into the earth, into the basics, into the like ground structure. What do you think about it?
I agree with that. I don't know if it's, it might be sort of somewhat compensatory, because it's both, like the image of the tree is very simple. So it may be that because of that premature and exaggerated reaching upward, some of us have become aware of the shakiness of our roots. So if we continue to reach outwards, we're going to fall over, and okay, time to focus inward. So I don't, it's not either or, it's both and, because the infinite space is within the body as well as outside of the body. It's a micro-macro relationship between within and without. So, but yes, if you're trying to open to what's outside of you and you're not opening to what's inside of you, then it's never going to work. I mean, openness, as I see it, is opening the senses. So, yes, if you open the senses, then you become more and more attuned to what's outside of you, possibly even to the whole universe. Potentially, we can be attuned to the entire universe through our senses, through the body. But the actual process of opening the senses is a going inward, because the senses are, they're not skin deep. The senses are sourced in the internal organs and the cells of the body and the blood and the bones. Like the whole body is a sensory organism. So in order to open the senses, we're talking about, I think, opening every cell in the body, expanding it, or relaxing it, or whatever the actual physical process is, I don't know, but each and every one of the cells of our bodies is a sensory organism, and it's only when they are all fully open and fully working together in harmony, or it's only as that is happening, that we're opening our outer senses and becoming aware of the universe outside of us. So then, yes, you start with the roots. No plant grows fruit before it's extending the roots. And I think that it's a symptom of, not to oversimplify, but trauma and dissociation of being introduced into a very hostile environment, into an unnaturally hostile environment from day one, and never having a chance to actually find the ground of our own being that has caused this over-emphasis on and this exaggerated reaching towards the outer realms, just as a perfect metaphor, that the humans, other species, but capitalist Western society anyway, is aspiring to space, to colonize planets, because oh, look what a state the planet is. Well, it's the same as saying, my body is, it's polluted because I've been drinking and smoking my whole life, so I think I'll just astral project and, build my macabre and fly off into the Pleiades and join my, my cosmic galactic kin. It's bullshit.
Yeah, I agree. Completely agree.
The body, this is the only body we have, this is the only planet we have. It's not going to be any different out there. We're not going to find an equivalent, much less a better place for our consciousness to reside than this earth and this body. And this moment is the only moment we have. We will just continue to repeat the same mistakes until we get it right. We can't just make a mistake and then, I get another body, I'll reincarnate, I'll go to another planet and do the same thing. It's like going from one relationship to the other and just abusing and being abused and then throwing that person away or being dumped and then finding another partner and expecting him to change. It's not going to change until we actually see what it is that's driving us to self-destruction.
And to end, Jason, we in Pyjama Surf have like lots of young readers. Do you have any advice or anti-advice you would want to share with them?
I noticed there's quite a lot of young people last night. That's nice. Well, I already said it, that what I didn't want to say, which is, don't do drugs and take care of your body, that is something that I wish I had someone that I trusted enough to listen to tell me when I was younger. It's very hard to give advice without being, what's the word for that?
Pretentious.
No, without just being pat and patronizing. But I think that the most helpful thing for anyone is to know that it's okay to be exactly the way that you are right now. Like, it's not being happy or living the life that you want to live doesn't and can't depend on remaking yourself in this perfect image that you might have, so that you can then live your life as that idealized image. The only way to begin to live is to accept who and what you are in this moment, and accept that you may never be able to change it, but you are what nature intended, regardless of all of your conditioning.
Yeah, paradoxically, that would be a great change, you know? So to accept the way you are, and that you maybe never will never get to change yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It is a great change, you know?
Paradox. It's like a paradox. I mean, self-acceptance is a paradox in itself, because there's a part of us that cannot accept the way we are, and that's the part that needs acceptance. The part that rejects ourselves is the part that feels rejected. So to accept what is within us that is always going to reject ourselves, that's like a conundrum. Like, how to do that? How to accept our own self-hatred? How to love our self-hatred? But you just do it by doing it. It's honesty again. If you're honest with yourself, it entails recognizing that you can't pick yourself up by your bootstraps. You can't actually use the ego to change the ego. You can't use the self to remold the self. It requires surrender to something greater than yourself. And that begins with a kind of humility. And humility comes from self-acceptance. Well, they come together, because if you're willing to be small and weak and flawed and afraid, if you're willing to be that humble, then you can accept your shortcomings. But yes, it's downsizing. You have to downsize your dreams, downsize your aspirations, downsize your ideas about yourself. And be, just be. Be like a plant, or like an animal, that's the basic ground of being, is that we're just a physical organism that needs water, that needs food, that needs sunlight, that needs affection, that needs love. Recognize your needs, see how you can meet them, find ways to meet them. But there's no need to aspire beyond that. At least not until you've taken care of. A plant may be able to grow into a great oak, but not until it's planted and it has the water and the sunlight that it needs. So, humility isn't just the right thing to do. It's a strategic approach to living. If you're humble, you recognize your needs and your shortcomings, you will actually be approaching life more pragmatically as well. And I'm all for advising pragmatism. My feelings about drug use, and it's not moral, of course, it's pragmatic. We've only got one body, we've only got a limited amount of energy, and we can only absorb a limited amount of toxins. And the mind is dependent on the body, not the other way around. We put the mind before the body, as if the body was somehow an outgrowth of the mind, but it's very obviously the opposite. Mind is a function of the body, but that's all it is. It's like digestion or pulse rate, or just one of the functions of the body that's taken over the whole system. So that has to be addressed, and one of the ways to address it is to observe the body and experience the body as much as possible as that greater system that we are. Identify through the body and not through the mind. The body's experience, identify with the body's experience rather than the mind's experience.
Great. Thank you, Jason.
You're welcome. Javier.
Gracias, Jason.
Javier.